Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you all so very much for coming. It's beautiful to be back here at White Feather Farm. My name is Meira Blaustein. I'm the co-founder and executive director of the Woodstock Film Festival, which is now in its 24th year. For the past 3 years, I think, ever since the second year of the pandemic, ever since 2021, we started doing our panels here at Broken Wing Barn and White Feather Farm. It's a beautiful barn. It's, I think, just coming in here, it just changes a little bit your state of mind. And then once you settle in here, each panel that we have here is just as wonderful as the other, just talking about different things. Earlier this morning, we had actors who direct. So we had Steve Buscemi, Matthew Modine, and Mary Stuart Masterson talking really about why it is that they're also working behind the camera rather than just in front of the camera. It was a really great panel. And today, this afternoon, we have assembled some amazing people. Each one of them is a leader in their field and have been working in the film industry for quite some time, to talk about where we are today in the film, in the independent films industry, and where they think, with their lens of a lot of experience, we're going. So I'd like to bring Wendy Ettinger, who is the co-founder of both Game Changer and Chicken and Egg, to come up here. She's going to be moderating the panel. And to talk with Wendy, I'm just going to step here so that they can come here. I'm going to bring John Sloss, Bob Burney, and Eugene Hernandez. Woo! Right there. Thank you all very much for joining us. And let the panel begin.
Okay, this is a test. All right, first of all, welcome everyone. And this is such a perfect place to be having this conversation because Woodstock Film Festival is the hub of independent filmmaking. So it's really thrilling to be here. And I have to say that it is such an honor to be with these guys because these are all great veterans of the indie industry, whether like writing about it or investing in filmmakers or identifying them. It's an extraordinary group to just talk about where we've been and where we're going. So I'm going to have you all self-introduce at this moment. Okay, Bob.
Hi, Bob Burney. I have a company called Picture House. And Picture House is my partner, Jeannie, and I. We've had it for a while, on and off. The original Picture House was part of New Line and HBO, which was then part of who acquired New Market Films. So we've had this history. And when I started, I ran Amazon marketing and distribution for a while. Then after 4 years of incredible corporate bureaucracy, I went back with Jeannie to be really indie. And just quickly, I just want to thank Meira and everybody here, and also particularly the audiences here. Been wonderful with the Q&A. We have a film here called At the Gates, and with the director, Augie, and the composer, Julia, right there. And I've just loved the interaction in the Q&A. So thanks, Woodstock, and the audiences.
Hi, everybody. My name is Eugene Hernandez. And well, I also want to thank Meira and everybody at the festival. I haven't been up here in a while, and it's really nice to be back. For my introduction, I've been coming to this festival for a while because I like the tagline, Fiercely Independent. It kind of just is something that I always kind of either aspire to or honor in the work I've been trying to do. I'm one of the founders of IndieWire, and I spent a dozen years at Lincoln Center at the New York Film Festival, which is why I typically the last dozen years wasn't able to come up here because it usually conflicted with the New York Film Festival. And now that I have a new job, I'm running the Sundance Film Festival and public programming at Sundance Institute. It doesn't mean my schedule is any clearer because we're in the throes of selecting the lineup for the next festival right now, but it does mean that I could break away from that work to be back here in Woodstock, and it's so nice to be back here, and I'm thrilled to be invited. Wendy, thank you for hosting us in this conversation. I'm glad to be alongside two guys that I admire very much, John and Bob, and good to see you.
I'm John Sloss, and I want to thank Myra and Woodstock. It's great to be back here, always. And I am most immediately and proudly the co-sales agent of the Grand Jury Prize winner of the Woodstock Film Festival, Rachel Hendricks by Victor Nunez. Yeah. Oh, there he is. There, I would have said it even if you weren't here. yes. And I'm a lawyer by training, and I still have a law firm, but I also run a company called Synetic, which I refer to as an advisory conglomerate. We don't make films, but we do everything we can to get them made and out into the world. And that includes sales, putting financing together, have a management company, have a big burgeoning marketing and publicity group, and have a corporate advisory group. There you go. Over to you, Wendy.
I thought we'd start by going back so we can look forward, because it almost feels like we're going full circle on this one. And I thought, actually, Eugene, if you don't mind starting just from an IndieWire point of view, kind of where we were and the trajectory to the extent you want to take us.
My first film festival was my first time going to the Sundance Film Festival, and that was 1993. And it was an interesting moment. I was just out of UCLA, and I found that the movies that were the most interesting to me at that time, were the films that were coming from the independent sector, films that from the mid-80s to the early 90s, I think were just some of the most, you know, exciting, bold. I'll throw Todd Haynes out there, because I got to watch his movie again the other night at the opening night of the New York Film Festival, May, December, and you all should check it out. But, you know, Todd's film, or Paris is Burning, a film that a few of us were talking about last night, there were so many interesting movies coming out of what was an interesting moment in American filmmaking in the late 80s and early 90s, and you can throw in certainly Michael Moore and Spike Lee and Richard Linklater and you know, so many other filmmakers and inspired by, you know, and influenced by the work of like John Cassavetes for sure and Jim Jarmusch. I think that there were a lot of folks in the late 80s, early 90s that were just really gravitating, like myself and friends of mine in college, to movies that were sort of outside of the Hollywood system, and movies that were not just about something, but also coming from a purely and really respectably passionate place. I thought about that sitting with Victor Nunez at the event last night, because his film was the Grand Jury Prize winner the very first year I went to Sundance. And Ruby in Paradise, the film that won that prize, again, was just such an influential and impactful film. So I think that what that moment really, what I'm thinking about when you ask me the question, is just that there was such an incredible movement of films being made kind of in just different parts of the country with a lot of different perspectives and backgrounds. And I mean, John and Bob can talk about how that work would eventually kind of seep into the culture through the work that they did to shepherd those films out, and others too, out into the world. And it was against a lot of uncertainty and against a lot of odds that would have, you know, sort of made you think sort of otherwise, that they might not make it, and yet these films did. And out of that work, a stronger movement of independent film, and then of independent companies, and then dependent companies within bigger studios, really took root. And so specialty film was in a really unique moment because of not only the work of these guys, but of the excitement of audiences for something different, and even though there was a lot of uncertainty at the same time. So that's what led us to explore and create IndieWire in the early 90s. But it was really in a response to the kinds of films like Victor was making and others, when you would go to festivals and just find something unique and special and different, and trying to figure out how to support that and how to help that work get out into the world.
And just out of curiosity, how many festivals were around then in the United States, say?
I mean, I think in the early 90s, there were certainly a lot of festivals. There were hundreds in this country. But it was a different moment. I started coming to this festival right at the beginning, so it's 24 years old now. And what you saw around 24, 25, you know, up to maybe 30 years ago was a number of communities like Woodstock, arts forward, arts-minded communities, really finding ways to create this kind of hub or home for independent work and storytelling as a way to not only connect with audiences locally, to support tourism locally, to engage sponsors and donors and supporters of the arts. And so you saw kind of a rush to create a number of festivals. Woodstock has survived, some festivals haven't. Some of those festivals have been attached to art houses. You know, Bob can certainly speak to that and the art house movement that's kind of led through all of that, and it's continued to face challenges. But you know, we're at an inflection point that I'm sure we'll talk about in a minute, where so many of the underpinnings of the work that I think we've all been doing for a few decades now is either threatened or is changing.
Bob?
Well, when in those days, there was also very rigid, rules or guidelines with distributors. And what we found early on is that we had to connect the audience in the films, we just had to go around the existing system in many ways. And, you know, with films like Happiness that had distribution, but then the parent company forbid them to do it and didn't want it ever seen by anybody, you know. And so we were able with the producers to find the money to then put it out. And the same thing with Memento. Memento, we all think now is a classic, but I remember meeting the financiers, and I showed them the film. I go, it's great. And they go, no, you understand, there are no offers at all. Zero. We cannot, this film will not come out. And I was like, if you raise your own marketing money, we'll do it. Jeannie and I will do it out of our house. And so we did. And even to a bigger extent, when I we were doing Memento, and then I got hired to start IFC Films, and they came, and we had E to Maman Tambien. No one wanted that because they thought it was going to be an NC-17 or at the time X, and no one wanted it. And I was like, well, then we'll just do it unrated. We'll put it out, and it worked. And then the IFC people came into me and they go, listen, here's the new plan. We have no money to buy films and no money to market them. I was like, okay. So I was kind of back to where I was. And they said, go out and find films like you've been doing small with producers that want to put up the money. Well, then we found one. The first one I found was My Big Fat Greek Wedding. Everybody had passed, the whole place. In fact, Lionsgate had made an offer and they just fired the acquisition person for making an offer. So then, you know, and I asked IFC at the time, do you want to invest? You could get in on this. And they're like, nope, we don't want any risk. And of course it worked. And I feel like to some degree, it's just connecting the audience. And in a way, we are to some degree, now it's changed and all this booming in the mid later after that, a lot of opportunities kind of before streaming came in. And in a way, that kind of we're kind of back to that world now on a much bigger scale. Even recently, like Taylor Swift, she didn't need distribution; she's going right to the audience. So anyway,
Sean, what about you with Synetic? Just growing the company and evolving for all these years.
Yeah, I mean, we're, as I said, we're a service company, so we don't necessarily make these trends. We just sort of amplify them. It's been a nice ride. My current obsession is really what I found was the primary sticking point on the Writers Guild and the SAG strike, which is data transparency. I was very dedicated as a lawyer and then as an executive at Synetic to sort of demystifying and adding transparency to revenue streams from exploitation. And we made a lot of progress over the years. You know, if you remember historically, there was Art Buchwald, who had net profits on a film and then sued because the film made $100 million and he didn't make any net profits. And that was studio accounting. That's what shined the light on studio accounting, which was a sort of dark art where there wasn't a lot of sharing of information. Then a movement started, which we were part of, to sort of, like I said, demystify the whole process of where the money goes from you know, consumption. And we made a huge amount of progress over the years, and then Netflix sort of came in and just decided, for reasons I was surprised by, considering, I mean, I know Reed Hastings and I know Ted Sarandos, and they're good guys, they're kind of enlightened guys, they came from tech, which is a very transparency-oriented business. And they just said, we're going to be a black box. We're not going to share any of our viewer data. We're not going to share any data. And that's our prerogative. And it really set the industry back about 50 years. It's fascinating to me. I was saying to Jeannie before, because I just sold a couple films to Netflix. One is May December and one is Hitman. And they're both great films. And one's by Todd Haynes and one's by Rick Linklater. And the primary mover in those acquisitions happens to be the son of Jeannie Burney and Bob Burney, which must make for some interesting dinner conversation.
We kind of have a wall.
Is that right? But it's a real problem, and I was sort of excited when the strikes came that maybe SAG was going to be able to accomplish what a lot of us couldn't accomplish, which was to get the streamers to basically share data so that filmmakers could see, you know, whether their film was successful, so that we could see whether their film was successful when we're trying to get their next film financed. And when, you know, so you could have a basis for residuals, you could... you know, there's infinite amount of benefits from having that data available.
Do you think the Writers Guild agreement tells us that they won't be able to achieve that with the SAG? Does it set the bar in a certain way?
With the opening of the New York Film Festival, I haven't had a chance to read it, although I have it. I don't know the answer to that. I have to, you know, I know the Writers Guild is declaring victory, but I think that might be
And don't you think that the advent of AVOD, advertising, VOD. So Netflix is moving into advertising, right? The only way to sell ads is to give somebody some kind of data. So I think it's coinciding.
Yeah, it's the two-prong approach. It's the advent of advertising VOD, which opens it up to sort of Nielsen-type analysis. But, I mean, even with the conversations with SAG and the Writers Guild, Netflix was saying, we'll give the data to a third-party auditor, but they have to agree not to give it to the filmmakers or the guilds. And it's like, what? So we could debate forever what real advantages Netflix gets or the streamers get from being so opaque, but I don't think it's worth, you know, what's the negative.
I think one thing too, just as an overview and history and everything, is that, you know, when we... In these early days, and all the studios too, there were so many revenue streams. So you had your theatrical, and then you had some kind of home entertainment. Then, you know, either at the time it was to pay one or HBO or cable, and then free TV and everything. And now with the streamers, there's one.
Yeah, I mean, I have 70 films in my office that pay overages from history, which is not an insignificant amount. And Netflix came in, and it was really a conflict because they were paying so much damn money, you know. And even from a filmmaker's, from everyone's standpoint, it's like, you know, do I stick up for the theatrical and all the media and, you know, the possibility of making money on the back end and betting on myself, or do I just take this windfall and give it to them for perpetuity, you know, as a buyout?
When we were the first Picture House, as I said earlier, was owned by New Line Cinema and HBO, but both Warner's companies, right? So we had, we invested in and made in advance a movie, Pan's Labyrinth, just an amazing film. So I go to the people at HBO and go, this is great. can't wait till we have the HBO premiere. They go, no, we're not taking that film. It's in Spanish. Forget it. We have hard and fast rules. And if it's Spanish or black and white, we don't take it. I was like, you're kidding, but you own half our company. So what am I supposed to do? And they go, I guess I'll have to go outside and sell it. And they go, yeah, but that's fine. There's no one that's going to do it. And I go, well, there's this new company, Netflix, that, you know, is interested. And they go, okay, those guys are losers. And then about 3 weeks later, the head of, you know, Glenn White, they call me and they go, did you sign that? And I go, yeah, you told me to. And they go, oh, shit. That's our competitor, you know. So, but I think it shows that what Ted and Reed and everybody did at the early days of Netflix was they're just flexible. They go, we don't care about any rules. Like, we don't care. We'll do it. You want a shorter window? You want this? You want that? We'll take it. And they did that to get in, and they really got in.
But it seems like now we're at a point where that at least still at a point where that's irresistible. I mean, you talked, John, about selling Rick's film and Todd's film to Netflix. So, I mean, there is advantage to the producers to get the money back for making those movies. Because how does Todd's movie get made? With less risk, or Rick's movie get made if you can't assure that return?
I mean, it's in those cases, you're exactly right, and that's for the lion's share of movies. That's how they get made. These movies both got made independently, and the sort of positive development tied to both those movies is that Netflix bought them for less than the entire world. So until about a year ago, if you were going to sell a film to Netflix and you had sold Danish TV, you basically had to go buy Danish TV back because they needed to hoover up every medium in every territory around the world in perpetuity. So I think that aspect of them is moving in the right direction. But, you know, we got those films financed independently, and we, you know, it's weird because Rick's film was developed at Netflix, then put into turnaround. We took it over to Apple. It was developed there with an assurance of a green light and got put into turnaround. And then we went and we raised the money basically through foreign sales and everything else. And then circled back to Netflix. Yeah, it was, you know, Rick is a paragon of the theatrical film experience. He started the Austin Film Society. They own a theater in Austin. He's very outspoken about this. He made some crack at Venice about the algorithm and how it killed Apollo 10 and a half, is the film he had, the animated film he had before at Netflix. And I said to him when we were selling this film, I said, you know, I hate to be so surgical, but what delta between what we're being offered by the all rights distributors and what Netflix would offer would make you feel okay about a Netflix deal? And he told me what that delta was. And I went to Netflix, I told them, and they said, okay, we'll do it. And
it's a change. You know, it's swinging back. It's mixture, because although Netflix remains pretty solid in their, you know, religious attitude towards theatrical, on the other hand, the other streamers are mixed. Like Amazon, when I was there, we were traditional theatrical. We did theatrical and everything, and it was very successful. Then new management came in, and they said, you know, first of all, I hate movies. And then the next thing was, it's all streaming. It's all streaming. Now, there's new management, and they bought MGM, and they're going back to wide-release theatrical. So, you know, it is changing and swinging back. But I think when you look at it, what's really tough is for the true independent films, because it's great that MGM will do wide release of kind of blockbuster films through Amazon. But what's going to happen to, you know, the smaller films? And there's no real, right now, there's no streamer that really wants to buy all these smaller indie films and make it like there's. So it is, I think that's the difficult part now. You know, it's tough for the films, a lot of the films here. It's a tough time.
I mean, that to me, that's the imperative behind for all of us of reigniting the theatrical experience, because I don't think the streamers are ever going to be behind, new voices and independent films. And the only way to really get them out in the world is to put them on in a theatrical, not a platform like a streamer, where they can be reviewed and where they can sit long enough for the word of mouth to really support them. And that's really the dangerous moment we're in terms of getting people back in the theaters.
But it's kind of like what Bob was saying earlier with the thing about IFC, where you're like, well, you no money to buy the films, no money to market them, but go have a business.
Yeah.
We're kind of at a similar place where, you know, I'm sure you know the size of MG, the size of a guarantee that a distributor makes right now, and you're trying to negotiate for how much you can get them to commit to marketing it. But I was, as an example, not to implicate my own festival in a certain way, but like it was a hard year for sales at Sundance this past year, and it's a hard market right now. Mm-hmm. I was talking to some documentary producers the other day, and about this, and I was also talking with, it was the opening night of the festival the other night, I was talking with a distributor and said that one of the sales agents, I don't think it was you, but one of the sales agents came to this distributor, smaller distributor, and basically said, hey, we've got like all these films that didn't sell from the festivals this past year. We're literally going to give them to you for no guarantee,
that
no money.
That definitely was not me.
I know it was not, but what they said,
you know that.
They said it was, we're going to give them to you for no guarantee up front, but just so you can get them out into the theaters. And the distributor said, I don't want to put the marketing money in, so we're not going to do it. So these films are being offered to distributors for no money whatsoever, and the distributor is saying, no, we don't want to put the money in. I mean, what is that? What does that portend for what you're saying, which is how do we rebuild that theatrical marketplace?
Who's
going to put these?
Well, I think there's one thing. There is a sort of, like I was talking about in the early days that we do, it's kind of come back to that in a way where we've been encouraging some producers or financiers to raise the money for theatrical in order to generate enough awareness to then hopefully get a VOD or streaming deal. And or it's for awards presentation. Like Jeannie and I have been doing a lot of documentaries with National Geographic, who really want theatrical, and they give us the time and the actual window to do that. But of course, it's all funded by Disney and Disney Plus. They do realize a value in having a theatrical release and a word of mouth and awareness for streaming. Kind of like when I did that at Amazon, there was a real value in doing that. But not everybody can raise the money, and you know. It's hard, but I think that is something that, you know, way to do it. There's been a lot of theaters like Rick's and everything, sort of nonprofit theaters there's been a lot of those that popped up. A lot of our art houses are gone. They didn't make it through that. Like in Los Angeles, we've just been devastated. Like the key Landmark Theater is gone. ArcLight, which was the most important theater, they all went bankrupt. And some have reopened. But a lot of them, like we just had, it's so strange, near our house in Eagle Rock, Vidiot's, the famous video store where Quentin worked, reopened with a theater. And I was like, it's a great sort, but it's a good one, but it's a nonprofit operation. And, you know, I was like, but are you renting DVDs? And they go, yeah, we're really busy. I mean, it's strange.
I was at Vidiot's the other night for the re-release, or the release of the Rent Restored Stop Making Sense. And I mean, you know, people certainly out the door to see the movie, and it was like the kind of preview opening with the band there and everything. It was an amazing night. The audience danced through the entire screening. I mean, literally, like just up the entire. It was like being at a concert. But on the other half of the business, and to Bob's point on the DVD side, there were the rental business was packed. The room was the rental store was packed. Like people were there to pick up their a DVD at their neighborhood.
It's a little, it's kind of a hipster, cool thing.
Yeah, kind of like vinyl for records, yeah.
Yeah, at vinyl, yeah. But I do think, that people that come to those experience or events, like we try to eventize our theatrical movie, like a lot of Q&As, a lot of special events afterwards. And when you do that, people really remember the experience that they had before. And it's starting to happen, I hope, with a younger audience too, that there's something out of it.
Yeah, there's, and there are these movements in parallel sort of springing up, whether it's eventizing, whether it's the rep house stuff. You know, my daughter, my 19-year-old daughter took me to 12th and 2nd this summer to watch Roman Holiday on the big screen, and it was packed. And there's more and more of that stuff. Tom Quinn released Old Boy, and it grossed more. 20 years later than it did 20 years when its initial theatrical release. And you know, at the same time, parallel to that, there is this movement toward disintermediating distributors that Bob referenced Taylor Swift, but there are a lot of people, you know, it's the promise, presumably, of the internet to connect directly to your constituency. And Kevin Smith was an early, you know, advocate of that and beneficiary of it. And these guys I work with, Broken Lizard, who did Super Troopers, the story of how they got Super Troopers 2 made is like a huge success story of going straight to your audience and getting them to sort of buy in to support that process. And that has to, while we're doing everything we can to get the audience back to the theaters, these new methods need to be supported.
And yeah, it's tough because with the art houses, a lot of them have literally gone away. And then that leaves the bigger circuits, right? So, but AMC and Regal, but after the pandemic, they're like, look, we love your films, but if we're not going to go bankrupt again, we have to play Marvel on every screen. And when we're slow, you know, okay, maybe we'll take care of you. But it's tough, and Regal's even worse. They're like, we literally just went bankrupt, and we can't afford to risk anything on something that's not a sure bet with big studio backing. So it's become tough.
And what I think about, and Wendy, you're so primed to share intel on this. What I think about is like what kind of pressure that puts on filmmakers. To, you know, I look at Andy sitting in the room. I overheard you, Andy, earlier saying you were traveling with last year's film, Last Flight Home. You've got new films that you're working on and putting out into the world, and you're traveling to like Harvard and Yale to talk about Last Flight Home. Like to eventize these films, the filmmaker is kind of like on the road in perpetuity to try to generate, you know, some meaningful revenue. And what kind of pressure does that put on filmmakers? We think about that a lot at Sundance, where the artist is the center of all the conversations and decisions we make. But what kind of pressure is this marketplace putting on filmmakers to really be like kind of on tour forever with your movie to try to support the ways that it's available digitally? And I'm sure you must see that with artists you're supporting and funding and nurturing.
Yeah, 100%. And not to mention the fact there are hundreds of filmmakers in the pipeline that we're all nurturing, supporting their work. And now there's no place for it to go. Like, where will it go? Who's going to buy it? That's a big question mark. So that somehow has to be subsidized, figured out, a new kind of platform. I mean, that will be a big challenge. Some make it to the art houses, which is great, or streamers.
I think, Eugene made a point. Can you afford, as a filmmaker, to go on the road for the whole time? We just did a film called Wildlife with, you know, Jimmy Chin and Chai, and of course, they're famous for, that's just, they live that stuff. They like, we'll do 400 Q&As a day, you know, and then they did. But how can you, you know, and luckily on that, like we had Disney Plus and Nat Geo paying for that, but it's hard. I mean, it works, but how many people can actually do that?
So what is... next, gentlemen? What advice would you give people in terms of they're in the middle of making their indie film, or they've made their indie film? Is there a strategy? Is there an emerging strategy? Are we all going to figure it out in this room? What do you think?
Well, I do think obviously the Woodstock Sunday, these festivals are important to get them seen. They are also all the festivals themselves, because it's impact of the pandemic and theatrical, everything, they're all struggling. So the whole system is really in trouble. I mean, it really is. So, but I do think like trying to think ahead on raising money for also to try to, you know, get marketing out there for your own film, but also hopefully there'll be somebody that decides on the streaming side to actually want to combine and have enough indie films to build it. But it's very tough to get enough subscribers when you are subscribing to everything else all the time. It's hard. I think there will be new companies that open up, because the theatrical is coming back enough. I think the people see an investment in all the different revenue streams, and that will increase the
possibility of international, like John was saying, international's been crippled too by the streaming. It's just like, you don't want to have to go out and get out of all your deals you just made because you had a streamer buy. So, but that, I think on certain films, it's starting to come back.
I think one thing, and further to what you're saying, Bob, is as the streamers consolidate over the next 5 years, and they will, because I don't think the world can support seven global streamers, or at least big box streamers. And as sort of more specialized streamers sort of come up between the cracks, like, you know, Criterion and Mubi and things like that, the streamers that survive are gonna offer these bundles to their viewers, to their subscribers. And there will be, you know, the big event films, there will be sports, there will be all these things. There's no reason why one bundle can't be new voices and new stories. Yeah. And that will be something that we all have to, I think, sort of redouble our efforts down the road to sort of voice, because the streamers don't—they don't have a grudge against, you know, new voices or anything like that. They're just business people. So I think that's a real possibility as things go on, as the arms race among these streamers starts to clarify itself over the next few years. I mean, you know, the problem is I've had a career of sort of giving clear answers to where things are going. This is a really tough time, because I think unless that happens with the streamers and unless people start coming back to the theaters, we'll hit around the edges with people who can raise marketing money and take their own film out and go to the Greenwiches of the world or something like that. And hopefully Bob will stick around and keep doing this for the next 30 years. And but this is a very, very hard time, and there's not actually a very clear answer to it. I mean, you can say to filmmakers, you should go get in and start directing episodics and things like that, and maybe that's a focus instead of raising money and, you know, making the film you always wanted to make to show your voice. But, you know, that's also not an easy world to crack as well. So there's no really clear answer.
I mean, I think the building on that, like, thinking about just where we are right now with even just being at this festival, I mentioned the tagline Fiercely Independent earlier, and I've been thinking about that a lot. And I think what I observe, and this goes back to where we started the conversation, Wendy, is, you know, fiercely independent filmmakers can be really ingenious and inventive and entrepreneurial when sort of placed in a position of making a movie and then not knowing how for it to find an audience, or trying to come up with ways to develop new alternatives to get it to an audience. So one of the things that I'm watching right now from my vantage point at Sundance, and also just from my vantage point on the indie side of this world for the last three decades, is the creativity that I'm hearing about and seeing in the not-for-profit sector. I know that there's this WhatsApp group that has been written about in the press a little bit, of writers who've been, you know, on strike all summer, and there's this really rich WhatsApp group of writers who are sharing information and knowledge and you know, venting, but also there's some creativity coming from that group and from that moment of our industry being stopped in many ways for such a long time now this year. There's some interesting ideas that are starting to emerge. I don't know what they'll morph into, but I can think of a couple of different conversations and tracks that I've heard about with folks who are looking at kind of non-profit or not-for-profit models for streaming that can be supportive of filmmakers, like the ones I mentioned earlier, that just films that just don't have a path, films that get into festivals like this one or the one I work for or others, and just can't find a path that the industry will buy into. So, like, to John's point, it's not that these companies are anti-new voices, they just don't have the right kind of risk-averse model to get those films out meaningfully. So filmmakers that I know about right now are developing alternate models that are supported by, you know, nonprofit arts organizations like the art houses that Bob's talking about, that maybe will tap into that art house network and also develop a more sustainable for sustainable for filmmakers model that can try to get some money back into their hands.
It's very tough with the older model of trying to get international sales for a film and stuff. That was always hard anyway. It's even harder because you start thinking, well, maybe we should have and I like it, but Jason Statham in our new art house movie. You know, you start going, that's how you sell it, or it has to be a certain genre with certain, just the same thing to get the money, and you just, there's got to be a better way. And mm-hmm. and I think coming when we get out of the pandemic, it's gonna of the after effects, hopefully that'll change a bit, or there'll be some hit movie that's so different that, you know, everyone goes, yeah, now we want to make that same movie again, which is usually happens.
I think that was Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Yeah, that was it.
This is a little bit of a pivot, but I don't want to let it go unsaid before we're done with this panel, and that is, there's an interesting sort of three-dimensional chess game occurring with the streamers, with the platforms now, where you see people like Max is licensing programming to Netflix, and it's actually increasing its viewership on Max. There's another sort of related phenomenon, which is, even though it's a reflex for the streamers to want to buy something in perpetuity, if you really press them, they will tell you that the practical value of it to them is at most 18 months, and because they're not really library players. And so to the extent the people who do what we do can take advantage of that and the willingness to sort of license to their competitors, then maybe the future is about selling films to someone like Netflix for 18 months instead of perpetuity, and then creating the aftermarket and the possibility for profits and just expanding viewers around the world by taking it off that platform and licensing it in other places.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. That goes back to the, you know, how it was with multiple revenue streams. So there's some hope for the investors to return it. And I do think I've seen that with shorter licenses and stuff.
Can we convince Bob and Jeannie's son at Netflix to try that out? We can call up Sean and see if he'll give it a chance.
Yeah, actually, it was interesting because our other son, Liam, was interning at Disney before all this happened in the DMED group. And there was a lot of discussion about that, you know, the retaining the brand and image so much that you're also turning down millions and millions of dollars by not doing that. Right. And I think that trend is happening. Yeah.
Yeah.
And what role do you all think technology is going to play into all this, or has played? I mean, in good ways, like DVDs, VCRs in the past.
I think on the marketing side, it's been amazing to try and reach, you know, the audience directly without, lower expense. So it gives the bars lower, the technology, you know, we one interesting thing in the theatrical world is it's only been like 2 years since these virtual print fees stopped. And so in other words, you know, for the past 12 years, there's been even though you're just sending it satellite or sending a drive, we've had to pay $1,000 each one to the theaters.
How did they get them to stop the virtual?
And there was an agreement that it expired, and then of course some of them it's like crack. They're hooked on. They try to keep it going, but that's reduced the cost of on a fairly wide release film by 20% or more. So there's been technology's been helpful, and also the kind of trying to get the exhibitors to get out of their own way in a way, like thinking about how to program, you know, not do you have to hold it for 4 weeks, you know, to get in? No, why don't you just, you know, have certain shows or play certain films on the weekend? And, you know, now you can do that you can just easily program all these things. So we had we were working with Apple on a film called Spirited last year, putting in some stuff in theatrical, and, you know, I found that it was partially because of the pandemic and there was desperation, but I got the exhibitors to really change and accept some day and date, which they were totally against. And also to say, well, just play it on the weekends, or just play this and play that, and all that kind of idea of programming. It's more like in the UK and Europe, they do this all the time. So I think just also a different, just looking at everything in a different way on how you program cinemas will help.
Yeah, I mean, there's this movement developing where films get released in theaters, and then when they go below a certain per screen average or a certain number of screens, it triggers, the VOD availability 3 weeks later. Mm-hmm. So it can be that flexible.
Yeah.
And technology, because, you know, it just like there's very little long lead press anymore. I mean, marketing can pivot on a dime and really create awareness very quickly.
Yeah, that's one thing we've learned, is that like the sort of call to action has to be quicker now, rather than these, you know, setting the trailer 6 months. And even on the major studios, it's got to be like you either have to go buy a ticket or be able to pull it up somewhere. And that's been a real change. When the theaters closed, we had a film ready to come out, and you know, everything closed, and we pivoted to premium VOD, and we're able to really, it was a great learning curve on learning how the marketing and the sort of just pacing of how you promote the film, how you buy media, and everything changed. And it was a great lesson to learn that I think can be applied just to straight theatrical as well.
If I could, I'll tell a quick story in response to your technology question. And I referenced it before, but the guys who made Super Troopers, which was a film I think we sold to Searchlight in 2002. It was 2002. It was a big success, you know, shipped $60 million in DVDs and things like that. And it was a tiny film that played midnight at Sundance. These same filmmakers, 17 years later, wanted to make Super Troopers 2. And Searchlight basically owned the underlying rights from having bought the film. And they went to Searchlight and they said, we have this great script for Super Troopers 2, and we believe our audience is still there, and they will come out to see it, and it'll be a big success. And Searchlight basically said, we don't believe you. We think that 17 years is too long, and all your, you know, your audience are all potheads, and they have very issues with memory and things like that. So we don't think they'll turn up. And so not only are we not going to finance your sequel, but even if you find a way to finance your sequel, you're going to have to bring $10 million of P&A in order to get us, and then Searchlight will release it. And they'll release it at full fees or something, you know, really.
And would they let them have the rights back too? Did they?
No. Not at all. So we all met, the filmmakers I met, and at that point I was really obsessed about crowdfunding, because I think crowdfunding, not as some kind of, you know, tokenism and your rewards, but literally as a way of rewarding your core audience and pre-selling consumption to your audience, just like they do with musicals on Broadway, where they'll sell $10 million of advanced sales. There's no reason why the filmmakers with audiences can't do that. So I said, well, maybe we need to prove to Searchlight that your audience is still there and still supports you. So why don't we go to Indiegogo. It was Indiegogo, which was a more democratic, you know, Kickstarter was curatorial. So, and Indiegogo would do anyone who paid the fee. So we went to Indiegogo and we offered to pre-sell downloads or theatrical premiere tickets, anywhere in the country where these filmmakers would tour and do theatrical premieres. And what they did is they ended up getting 45,000 contributors. They raised $5 million, which was a huge part of the budget, just by pre-selling consumption. And when Searchlight saw that, they said, okay, we'll put up the P&A. And they ended up making the film. Searchlight paid for the release of the film, and the film grossed twice as much as the original Super Troopers. So it's, and that really is a tribute to technology and their direct connection to their core audience.
Yeah, that's helpful. All right,
How much time do we have? Because I just wanted to ask Eugene one question before. Great. Okay. So Eugene, hot seat. You're about to take over Sundance here. What do we all expect?
Well, I mean, I think there's no shortage of films being made, and that's a great thing. Last year, I think Sundance had somewhere in the neighborhood of about 15,000 submissions. About 11,000 of those were short films. We haven't released the numbers yet for this year, but we just passed our submission deadline. There's still some films that are trickling in, probably from filmmakers in this room, who we've given extensions to, happily. So I expect the numbers will be on par or higher than the submission numbers will be on par or higher than last year. What you can expect is kind of related to your last question, your previous question, which was about technology. We're continuing to explore and try to understand the impact of sort of streaming on festivals and how what the notion of a hybrid festival will be, what festivals will look like in the next, you know, when Woodstock is celebrating its 50th anniversary, like what is the next 26 years going to tell us about festivals and the way audience habits are evolving in relation to both experiencing something in a room like this together and seeing movies like we have been this weekend in theaters, but also the fact that we want to see a lot of movies sometimes at home. And we want to have an opportunity to kind of satisfy our adventurous taste around that. And some of that isn't satisfied by the more traditional streamers. So one of the things we're continuing to explore and pilot, and this is the third year with input from people like John and others, and trying to be responsive to the sales community and not hurt, but rather help our filmmakers, is having this hybrid window that happens within the festival. This year, you'll see it happening later in the festival. So we won't stream a single film until the second half of the festival, just for the few days during that final weekend when the awards and the conversation happens at the end that kind of can bring some attention. A very narrow number of streams, so that because of what, like even what Bob was saying, like you don't have the same level, and John was also talking about like just like press and journalists and others whose outlets can't afford to send them to festivals or who can't spend as much time at festivals. It means that those films can't really get the coverage that is hopefully going to support John when he's trying to sell the film to a distributor. So by making the film available in a small window at the end of our festival, it allows more audiences, critics, journalists, some industry to watch in the second weekend when they go home, and hopefully gives those films a slightly better chance of stirring a conversation. So that's something we're continuing to pilot and explore. This will be the third year of Sundance. My first year fully at the festival, but it'll be the third year of Sundance having a narrow window. And if you're able to secure one of those digital tickets for that second weekend, you'll have a chance to kind of have a little sneak preview of some of the films that will be coming later in the year. So that's the biggest thing that we're continuing to figure out how to evolve. At the same time, just to kind of put a final point on it, is we're also protecting, it means we're protecting and preserving the first half of the festival as a purely in-person experience. Mm-hmm. Because, I talk about this a lot in my meetings with colleagues, is I think a lot about, I've been reading some articles and books and things about the founding of Sundance, and one of the things some of the founders talk about, were founded by Mr. Redford, Robert Redford, they talk about kind of the festival being a place of first impressions. You really get this chance, if you're a filmmaker at a festival, to get that first impression. And how important in any aspect of our life is that first impression, the first time you encounter someone or something, and those first impressions can really kind of stick with you. So how do we at Sundance really give our filmmakers the best possible shot at a first impression? It means choosing the best films we can from those 15,000 submissions, and then scheduling those films in a way that audiences can discover them. Hopefully John can bring, you know, buyers to the screenings. Hopefully Bob will be there at one of those first couple screenings, so that there's an opportunity for those filmmakers at least to be considered. Whether the film is going to make big deal or whatever is going to happen, at least there's a chance for the industry and the critics and the audience to at least have a chance
to kind of create that groundswell, that noise, that buzz, the social media, et cetera. So we're really emphasizing and preserving that first impression experience. And you'll see us really, really working hard to give each of the filmmakers we choose this year the best shot at that first impression. And then the little narrow window at the end so that audiences in other parts of the country can sample and hopefully talk about those films. And then hopefully those films will find a place out in the world. But that's the biggest thing that's evolving. Festivals can be really expensive to travel to and to participate in. And how do we connect our films with audiences who can't have a chance to sit in a room like this, aren't maybe not privileged or don't have the resources of many types to be in the room with us here for something like this. So it can be part of this bigger community and this bigger conversation around independent films.
Excellent. I can't wait.
Thank you.
Shall we open up to questions? I'm not sure how you all want to do this.
Well, I've been a long time video maker, and a certain kind of documentary I call advocacy videos. But so I've had this phrase for many years, because it bothers me, the aftermarket for documentaries I'm talking about now. That there isn't one, very few get a theatrical release, a few, but not many, and then they make the festival circuit, and what? And so my phrase is documentary as curriculum, that there's a whole educational marketplace that I can tell you as a video guy, it wasn't there. You could not access a global educational marketplace, but suddenly, post-COVID, you can, and everybody, oh, video. Well, let's watch videos. Yeah, exactly. And videos will kill any teacher standing in the front of the room talking, or a textbook. I mean, just destroy. So much more effective, right? So, but if we don't establish that pipeline, I can tell you, as me, man, it's like nobody's there. It's not set up that direction. People think theatrical feature, right? Mm-hmm. And there isn't any theatrical for most documentaries, and then what? You go to the next festival, or you get your resume up, and that documentary is ancient history. So that's why I just like help with that direction, documentary as moving into curriculum to find a different kind of revenue stream that lasts indefinitely.
Is that a question? this is an unpopular, it may be an unpopular point of view, but I think in a way, the desire for a theatrical release of documentaries actually kept documentarians and documentaries from understanding their full inherent commercial value. And the interesting thing is because, I mean, there were always breakthrough theatrical documentaries, but by and large, people, in my opinion, were reluctant for some psychological reason to go to movie theaters to see documentaries. I think what a group of us found out with a black box from Netflix over the years is that people love watching documentaries. Mm-hmm. And when Netflix started paying more for documentaries, even though they weren't telling us how many people were watching them, we took those breadcrumbs and figured it out. And we've helped create a much bigger market for documentaries. And the point is, what make in this sort of largely post-movie star reality, what makes a scripted narrative more necessarily compelling than one, filmed from real life? And so I think if we sort of untether ourselves from the need for theatrical, and a lot of us did, you'll see more and more money pouring into the documentary market and more eyeballs available because it sort of builds on itself. But at the same time, the point you're making about impact and educational networks growing, that is certainly true. I don't know whether COVID had to do with it or not, but there are distributors, a growing number of distributors out there who are basically, whether it's Roku or anyone like that, who are really leaning into that market and helping grow that market as well. So I think it's actually a very healthy time for documentaries.
Yeah. Okay. Hello. Oh, I have to stand. Okay, good. I'll stand. Hi, guys. Thanks so much. Banking off of what the gentleman just said, the idea of knowing where these things are is the hallmark of our age. I mean, this is what's going on. I mean, back, you know, we have shifted from atoms to bits. Okay, well, Nicholson and Agnopati said that. I didn't say it. But when I took my horror film out to the AFM in 1980, we carried five cans of 50 pounds worth of stuff out there. Now, I sit there, I push a button, and it goes out all over the place. So we're in a creative destruction mode with our business, which has had 100 years of distribution mechanism making it work. And we're also in a creative growth period with it, trying to figure out how it's working. But at the same time, it's changing beneath our feet every day. And everybody's trying to keep up with it. And now, you know, streaming as a business is mostly North America, if I have it correctly. It hasn't really moved in big time into Europe and other places in Asia. But as it is now, and AVOD and FAST showing up, that's driving the industry in a whole other way now. I mean, we seem to be going back to linear TV games with FAST. And at the same time, are these distributors and everybody looking at what the new people that are going to be looking at American movies and all kinds of movies? We're competing with Korea. We're competing with all these companies, and we're letting Korea, you know, they're winning. We're not letting them. They're winning Academy Awards. So we're in a completely different place. What do you think the advent of all of this with everybody walking around with a movie theater in their pocket is going to do to this whole business? And how do you keep theatrical movie work alive? It's an experience game now. It's going for the event, the experience, versus you can have it at home if you drive these watching parties and have everybody there. But how do we manage that? How do you see that happening?
Well, one thing that's interesting is that happened in the pandemic, but it just accelerated it is the hard and fast rules that were there that couldn't be broken. You know, the sort of certain windows had to be 6 months, 9 months. And in that way, there was a lot of problems with that. Like some films that just didn't, you know, they just didn't play theatrical for over. And then you had to wait so long, then spend the money to relaunch them then spend the money to relaunch it on pay. So I think that part where the rules broken down is good, because it was just too rigid. But I do think, and also I think that when you talk about some of the international business, like there's been production increased everywhere by the streamers, like Netflix, you know, in all these places. And also I find it interesting that Netflix has actually made the U.S. market completely accept subtitles and everything, like everybody just watched. So there's been, I don't know, there's been a lot of interesting positive changes. We just have to figure out what do we do now when there are no rules and no, you know, there's no, you just can't count on certain things. But I do think that as it swings back a bit, that there'll be theatrical will be a part of it for sure. And there'll be shorter windows and you'll be able to jump to VOD or streaming quicker and have the revenue. Like I have hope that there's going to be a way to figure this out, but it's just the wild right now. Like no one knows what to do. But I do think that theatrical will survive. And it's true. Streaming is picking up, though, in other places. There's been a lot of just legal and protectionism, you know, like France and stuff. But that's all changing, too. I mean, it's not that long ago that, and I think it still is, that, you know, Cannes won't play a film from Netflix. But it's not, they want to, but it's the projectionist union and the theater, there's all sorts of stuff, but now that's starting to change. So it's just a wild west all around the world.
Why are we not, since we can send movies to our homes, are they not sending it to theaters? Everything's done with a DCP. Still got to go with Adams. Why are we not using bits? Why are we not sending movies directly to the theater so they can work really quickly to make changes? If this isn't playing, they can bring something else in. Stopping that?
Technically, you can. It's just trying to get the owners to do that. And like I was saying earlier, the UK, like Regal in the UK, has been doing that, and it's starting to happen. But yeah, that it's another one of those things that there's all these rules that, you know, you don't have to follow. But I think that will happen.
Right in front.
Hi. Yes. Okay.
Hi, I'm just wondering, is there any conversation or thought about personal ownership of films again? I personally love my DVDs. I love the privacy of watching whatever I want to watch when I want to watch it and having them on a shelf and having books on a shelf. And now everything is not my property. I may get a download, but mostly I just get tracked while I'm watching. So what are the conversations about that?
I don't think we're really going. I think it's going to remain a novelty. I don't think hard format ownership is going to have a huge renaissance, to be honest. Sorry. Sorry. Or maybe we can start here in this room.
Yeah.
I'm just to pivot away from streaming for a moment, and I'm wondering, I'm thinking about a couple of companies, A24 and Neon, who have not only committed to sort of a more traditional model of theatrical release and multiple revenue streams and also riskier storytelling, and they've had financial success, they're dominating the awards. Is there the possibility of more growth? Are more people going to jump into that space? Are they going to grow more? Because between the two of them, it's what, 20 to 30 movies a year? It's not enough. But why, if it's working there, isn't there more growth in that part?
I think it will. I think there will be new companies. I mean, it takes financing. I mean, A24 has been super great about branding themselves and build and taking the time, a slow build over, so they can directly access the, their constituents. So I do think, I mean, they have a certain niche in a way. They've gone, you know, very, they have sort of prestige and genre and a lot of horror films and stuff, but going for the audience, I think initially that really responded to the new technology. I think same way with Neon, they have a good taste. They probably need more money, you know, like, but I think that you're right. I think there'll be more. Jeannie and I are going to raise money and do more where we're looking, so we talk to people, but we, but it, it's, I do think you're right that there's been more companies now that things are kind of, we're sort of understanding the current streaming market and everything. And I think the thing, the important key to that is, can these companies or get a, what I would call, and John, like an output deal, like we used to have with HBO. Can this happen with streamers?
I mean, I think the short answer to that is absolutely. The streamers are really hungry for those output deals. You know, Sony Classics was able to do a very aggressive output deal with Netflix for their pay one window. And I think the example, the positive example of A24 and Neon together with this whole movement toward theatrical viewing of repertory stuff for a new generation and the grain of people, I hate to say this because they're my colleague or they're my peers, is you know, Sony Classics and has created a huge opportunity in the marketplace. And Bob and Jeannie will certainly fill it, hopefully. Yeah. But I think there are going to be others coming in. So I think that's good news. And obviously, we need to promote that as much as possible.
Yeah, just to follow up on what I was saying about an output deal, it would be like if you do theatrical, you have a guaranteed percentage based on that theatrical numbers from a streamer. That's how in the 2000, mid-2000, that's how Searchlight, Folk, that's how all of them survived over their either Showtime or HBO deal. And then it went away. The streamers didn't want to do those, and they want to make their own movies and make control everything. But as John said, now they need other people to make, and they're willing to do it.
And further to the point I was making before about the short effective windows in each of these streamers, the future may be not only making those output deals with the streamers, but making three or four of them in succession. And smart distributors will start doing that, and that will make them economically viable, or at least certainly help.
And it is interesting, just to add to Peter's question, just or to make a point, is that there also is this really tremendous loyalty that I think both those companies have been able to nurture with their audience. Neon with their choices and really putting that name forward and having that name stand for something. I think what the team there is doing there is really smart. And I think with A24, yes, they're very loyal to the theatrical experience, but I have a really nice A24 candle in my living room that I light when I'm watching a movie at home, and it creates a really special...
I do have an A24 lighter as well. So, you know, they're also enhancing my home viewing experience with that beautiful candle. But I think that they've created such loyalty. I mean, I have friends, especially friends who are like 20s and 30s, folks who I work with, who it doesn't matter what movie A24 is putting out, what genre, what if it has that name, or Neon, other companies, if it has that name attached to it, they will go out and see that movie. And that's some loyalty that you haven't seen in our space.
It's crazy. I mean, what studio engendered that kind of loyalty other than Disney many, many years ago? Yeah,
they've been very smart about it. I remember when I first started Amazon, we would, before I built out the team, we would go to all different distributors and hire them and put, we'd pay for the money. We did the marketing, but we just like, here's some money. And everybody did it except them. And they're like, we're not going to do it because we want only our name on it. And I was like, you guys are really smart. Don't take my deal.
Hi. I have a question for Eugene and a two-parter. What does the future of film festivals look like right now when things aren't selling? Like, what impact is that going to have on festivals? And John and Bob, are we going territory by territory now? Are films going to sell? Like, I heard that Netflix just is buying U.S. distribution. They're not doing worldwide.
Netflix is doing worldwide.
Yeah, I mean, no, but for, like, let's say documentaries. Some documentaries are just picking up U.S. rights for. Is that the wave of the future?
Well, I'll take part of that question, obviously, is the festival part, and John and Bob can speak to the industry side of that. I mean, I think we're trying to figure that out. Eddie, I think that it's like what I hope that there still remains a place, and we're investing in continuing to create spaces where, like this, we can come together, have conversations, get to know each other, sit in the same room together, watch movies in the same place. But again, these are privileged spaces, and at festivals, there's limited number of tickets. There's a limited amount of access. It can be expensive to come to. We talked earlier about like festivals. You know, to Wendy's question, like festivals, kind of where we were 25 years ago. So many festivals we all started going to 25, 35, 45 years ago. We're a little more down and dirty, a little more indie. And you know, the festivals have been so successful that it's a little bit harder to crack the nut of some of these now increasingly expensive towns to be able to attend a festival like this. So that's a challenge. So that's something that I think festivals have to figure out how to react and respond to, continuing to do what they do best, which is bringing community together, often in connection with an art house or an art house audience. Up here you have Upstate Films, for example, and I'm assuming many of you who live locally watch films there or participate in some of the events that the Woodstock Festival does year-round. To have that ongoing connection with the organization and with the art house or with the festival group year-round. But we're also, at Sundance, really thinking about the digital piece of that. How do we continue to engage and support artists through digital technology, digital opportunities, through streaming throughout the year? And so that's something that in the public programs side of what I do at Sundance, I'm really trying to think about and listen to and learn about how audiences want to engage with movies, and how Sundance, for example, can be a bridge between the artist and the audience. In partnership with institutions like this one and other art houses, we support the Art House Convergence Network. Sundance is the fiscal sponsor and has been nurturing this Art House Convergence Network of theater owners, independent nonprofit theater owners around the country. So how can we collaborate with them to help support this infrastructure that is already out there and it's very loose and kind of maybe needs a little bit of support to sort of continue to survive amidst all of the other mainstream theaters that are also going through these big changes that Bob was talking about earlier. So that's the festival piece of it. I think the festivals will continue to evolve and probably will look a little bit different increasingly, but on the industry side.
I mean, in terms of documentaries, more than half of the documentaries I sell to the platforms, to the streamers, I sell for the world. So that is a very real possibility. The ones that aren't, I mean, you know, documentaries have a challenge, you know, as we're growing, as we're trying to make the world aware of the fact that people like seeing true stories, let's say it. We are, There are documentary sales agents who do very well selling territory by territory. I can give you the names of a bunch of them afterwards. But so that's a very real market internationally. There are some territories, and this was always the rap against England, the UK, that they had such a high level of documentaries on the BBC and Channel 4 that the idea of people going to the movie theaters to see them or of you know, watching them on Netflix wasn't as enthusiastic as in other territories, and that's, I think, in large part true. But it's anecdotal; it's territory by territory. But there's still a very vibrant market, both globally and territory by territory.
There's just one up here in the whole country, so we can close it up there. Yeah.
Just going along with the crowdfunding idea, and I don't know, to me, what I've seen
work in other industries like real estate, or even you can invest in painting now, you can get like fractional shares in painting. Like, have you guys seen any kind of movement towards, you know, like very fractional kind of investing in films?
I mean, I think anyone who invests in films as a purely economic investment should have their head examined. I think it doesn't have to be a complete loss of money, but you need another thing, you know, whether it's supporting a story that's being told or the people telling it, to really make it make sense to you. And I think anyone who tells you otherwise isn't being straightforward. So I think even though there are laws that have been passed to enable fractional investment through crowdfunding as equity, I don't really support that. I think the idea of pre-selling to your core audience and making them the huge booster in your film and privileging them over the general public is really the future of crowdfunding. So that's where I would probably steer you.
Yeah. We sort of, you know, we distributed.
He's too modest. He's too modest. He was responsible for my Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Yeah. Yeah. On the marketing side, on the positioning of what happened was the rights were split. HBO funded the movie, but a company, Gold Circle, had international rights, so the rights were split, and so they needed a theatrical to generate international sales, especially back then. And HBO goes, forget it. Like, we're not doing that. We made the movie, kind of a favor. You know, we don't really love it. So the Gold Circle put up all the money. But we did work with the filmic, with Rita and particularly Gary Getzman, on the idea of going through Greek churches and everything and doing everything different. And I think the most radical thing we did was we kept the film, even though it was through the roof, we deliberately kept it at 500 screens. We started small platform, and everybody, the exhibitors, like, well, come on, let's go wide. And we said, no, we're just going to keep the screens full and laughing at everybody, and kept it that way for 6 months, and then went wide, and it played a year. And, you know, Gary and the people, they were worried about every big studio movie that came on. Oh, we're going to die. The May movies are going to kill us, the summer movie. And finally, we were talking about the Christmas movies. They're like, the Christmas movies are going to, and it was a year later. But I think it was like, again, just doing thing outside the way everything was done. And luckily, they were all, Rita and Gary and Tom, they were all really supportive, because some people would have said, you know, just go, just take as much money. And I don't think it would have ever done the same thing.
It makes me curious about, because it's very, what made it work was isolating a group against the party. We had two mechanisms to reach anybody.
Yeah.
I mean, the internet is built for that.
Yeah.
We can find any which we want.
Yeah.
So where is that? Who would be working on that?
Well, I think all of distributors are. They are there as work. I think the idea is to collaborate with the filmmakers who know their audience and know their product, and work with them to do it. And now we have the technology, we can do it more. Back then, it was really like literally just, you know, one city by, you know. So I think we do have
the technology. Is there an example right now of somebody who's pulled off a hit by using that mechanism?
Well, I think almost, I would say the everything, you know, the A24 film. And I think they do that really well. Yeah. And particularly the No, that was different. That was Apple, which I think, in a way, I don't think they did, because I think they that film actually would have benefited from a longer theatrical and word of mouth and stuff, and they kind of threw it out, in my opinion.
All right. Well, thank you all for a very candid.
Thank you so much.
Thoughtful, and thank you all for coming.
Thank you, Wendy. Thank you so much.